legitimately an American.
Broadcasting from the gulag city of planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Our technical producer is Steve Nolan. Our guest this evening is Ethan Nadelman. And I want to make a quick announcement. Next Tuesday at 10 a.m., I have been invited to join Hitachi Aziz for a two-hour special, Earth 101, to discuss the drug war and its disproportionate impact on people of color. I invite you to please listen each afternoon for the 420 Drug War News right here on KPFT Houston or online at kpft.org. At 4:20 p.m. Monday through Saturday Central Time and a couple of other times in the early a.m., I will bring you the Drug War News. We're going to take a few listener calls a little later in the show, and I ask you to please have a quick question or comment ready. Our number here, 713-526-5738. The Drug Policy Alliance is the leading organization working to end the war on drugs and to promote new drug policies based on science, compassion, health, and human rights. The Alliance, headquartered in New York City, maintains offices in California, Washington, D.C., New Mexico, and New Jersey. And I want to welcome the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance to our show, Mr. Ethan Nadelman.
Hiya, Dean. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, Ethan, for joining us. I appreciate it so much. Ethan, I want to say something. In my opinion, over the last few weeks and months, perhaps we have begun to see the end of this long and tragic drug war. And that's not to say that the abuses of the drug war have not continued, but rather to say that the monster, as I call it, the superstition, the lies, and the demonization are starting to be shown to have no real merit, no connection to science, no relation whatsoever to compassion, and truly to have no basis in reality. And I was just wanting your response to that.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I hope you're right. I mean, I have to say, if I'd been on your show about 4 months ago, I would have been a lot more despondent. I mean, we'd come out of the election in November. We'd had a series of ballot initiatives around the country for treatment instead of incarceration and marijuana reform and changing the mandatory minimum drug laws. And we got beat in most of the places we tried it. We lost one in the Supreme Court last year where the government wants to be able to drug test all high school kids. Just a number of setbacks. But then something seemed to click a few months ago. You know, I mean, you had those crazy Canadians up there. All of a sudden, the Prime Minister is talking about decriminalizing marijuana. And in Vancouver, you have a mayor who's very much an opponent of the drug war speaking out now. You know, then you go down to Tulia, Texas, and you see this outrageous injustice where about 10% of all the black people in town were arrested and convicted on the word of one corrupt police officer. And then the courts basically throw that out and let these people go free, and the corrupt police officer is being prosecuted for perjury. Then you go to Washington, D.C., where we thought there was no chance for anything good to happen on drug policy. And in fact, we found we've been able to beat back the bad guys on the ways in which they want to use more and more taxpayer money to run these stupid ads and such. So I'd say that all around the country, more and more good little things are happening. And it may well be that your sense that some element of common sense, respect for science is finally seeping in, that you may just be right.
Well, thank you. There's a story, it actually started 2 years ago, but I'm going to read to you from the Houston Chronicle. It says, six men were sentenced to federal prison today, this was published yesterday, for distributing a lethal drug cocktail that killed 15 people in Houston in August of 2001. They say these six men were sentenced to prison terms of up to 16 years apiece. None of the men, all Houston residents, are eligible for parole, and each was fined $3,000. Six other defendants were set to be sentenced next month. And as authorities said, the drug was mixed at the home of one of these gentlemen, distributed to others, and then sold on the street. And the test showed the drug was 53% heroin, 37% cocaine, and the rest cutting agents. And what do you say about that situation, Ethan?
Well, you know, one of the scariest things about the whole black market in drugs, the whole illicit market, is that there's essentially nothing resembling an underground Food and Drug Administration to regulate the quality of drugs that people buy on the streets. You know, I mean, just imagine if every time you bought an aspirin, you didn't know if it was 5 milligrams or 500 milligrams, or if every time you bought a bottle of wine or booze, you didn't know if it was 10% alcohol or 90% alcohol. You didn't know if it was methyl alcohol or ethyl alcohol, just like what happened with people during alcohol prohibition. Well, I mean, that's the problem with the illicit drug market today. You know, if you buy marijuana, maybe you get ripped off, you get bad quality marijuana, what have you, or maybe it's more potent than you expected, so you just have to lie down for a few minutes. But when you're talking about the powder drugs, the things that are being sold as ecstasy or the stimulants, the methamphetamine, there's a lot of dangers involved in the preparation of those. That's why I think, and that's why the position of Drug Policy Alliance is that as much as possible, we want to try to move from the current drug prohibitionist policy, the one which has all the problems and all the failures of alcohol prohibition, into some alternative policy that, even if it falls short of full legalization, at least pushes the criminal justice system to the edges of the policy and allows some sensible regulatory approaches to take over.
An excellent thought, sir. Since 9/11, the powers that be, the president, John Ashcroft, Tom Ridge, and the various drug czars, have tried to tie these terrorist attacks to drugs and to drug users. And again, your take on that.
Well, I mean, you can see what they're doing. They know that they have a failing war on drugs. They know that, you know, overwhelming majority of Americans believe that the war on drugs has failed, and a solid majority believe it cannot even work. People are frustrated. They see tens of billions of dollars going down the drain each year on the failed war on drugs. So what do, the drug warriors? They try to bolster it by hooking it up to a fairly popular war on terrorism. You saw those ads they ran in the Super Bowl last year, you know, trying to tell kids if you smoke a joint, you're supporting bin Laden. I mean, just craziness, just absolute bull. But in a sense, the war on drugs and their advocates have always been to some extent shameless. You know, they're trying to find a way to keep this thing going after 20 years of conspicuous overriding failure. Now, one of the things I'm real worried about is that there's a case coming out of North Carolina in the last week or two in which a prosecutor is saying, maybe we can use these anti-terrorism laws to go after some drug dealers. Now, you already have very tough drug laws against drug dealing. It's not as if you need that. But to start to take these laws that are designed specifically to deal with political terrorists and to start to apply them to an ever-broadening range of Americans for routine criminal offenses, I think that ultimately poses a tremendous threat to what it means to be an American citizen and to our basic constitutional rights.
Yes, Ethan, I know you've been following these recent developments in Congress where we're getting closer to a balance, at least insofar as the votes for medical marijuana, the funding for Columbia, et cetera, et cetera. And in the polls have now shown that 80% of Americans now believe in the use of medical marijuana. I read the transcripts from some of those debates, and I'm just wondering, your take, what is the black magic that Congress uses to maintain this jihad against pot smokers?
Well, I'll tell you, Dean, I mean, what's interesting, last week Congress voted on an appropriations bill that would prohibit the DEA and other Justice Department agencies from spending a penny to go after medical marijuana in California and the other states that have made medical marijuana legal under state law. And over two-thirds of the Democrats in Congress voted for this. I mean, just a few months ago, the Democrats were running away from this issue. And now you have two-thirds of them standing up on behalf of, you know, compassion, on behalf of states' rights, individual freedom, and against the kind of overreach of the federal government. And we even had a dozen Republicans. Now, if truth be told, and some of the Republicans said this, that if this vote had been done anonymously, if people had been able to vote their conscience, odds are that medical marijuana bill would have passed Congress. What's happened, in fact, is that there are some extraordinarily fanatical anti-drug crazies who are really driving the drug policy of this administration. And people are fearful of breaking ranks. I mean, the polling shows that something like 80% of Democrats say marijuana should be legal for medical purposes, but it also shows that almost 60% of Republicans believe it should be legal for medical purposes. So I think, Dean, it's only a matter of time. I mean, more and more states are changing their laws. More and more bills are being considered. It's going to happen.
Let's see if I can remember the quote. I think it was Mark Souter in that debate, and he said, marijuana may contain some medical marijuana, but it's not marijuana, and it's available elsewhere. And, you know, that's the type of logic I guess he's holding one of those banners you speak
well,
of.
Well, you know, I mean, it's almost when you go back and you read the transcripts from Congress from 1937, when Congress first criminalized marijuana under federal law in the Marijuana Tax Act, you read this and you think they're joking. Because it's so strikingly uninformed, it's so full of exaggerations and just flat-out lies and mistruths. And then you realize these were congressmen being serious on the floor of Congress. And the tragedy is, you jump forward to 2003, and you have these characters saying stuff, you know, that would get them failed in any high school science or health exam. Yet because they're congressmen, they can say it loudly and boldly, no matter how false it is.
Well, sure, and I noted that three of the, I'll call it the Republican side, stated that it's necessary to continue this jihad against medical marijuana because more than 600 police organizations deem it to be appropriate.
I know. I mean, that's the real tragedy, which is you talk to a lot of policemen, you know, quietly over beer or coffee, what have you, and many of them are incredibly cynical about the war on drugs. You know, they're a little uncomfortable with medical marijuana because they don't want people sort of blowing smoke in their face and laughing and saying, I'm medical, you can't arrest me. But when you present police officers with the opportunity to have this stuff be better regulated, there's take it out of the black market, make it just like any other medication, police officers start speaking a whole different tune. I mean, the problem, of course, is in American society, the people, the law enforcers, the cops, the prosecutors, the prison guards, no less, have greater political weight than ever before in American society. That's a fairly scary thing in a democracy like ours.
I do find it astounding that policemen are making medical decisions, and in some cases, the doctors make legal ones. I just don't understand that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you see, too, you know, who's in charge of which drugs can be legally obtained with the prescription of a doctor? It's not, you know, the medical part of the federal government. It's not the health department. It's the DEA. It's the federal police agency, the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. They're the ones who get to say, no, this drug cannot be used by you as a medicine. We know. We're cops. I think that's a fundamental flaw in the way the federal government's regulating the whole drug policy.
Oh, yeah. Ethan, I really enjoyed an article I saw. It was written by you. It was published, I can't remember the name of the website, but I found it on Narco News. And it outlined several proposals that you had that would offer the South and Central American countries some respite from the horrors of the drug war. And I was wondering if you'd summarize that piece for my listeners.
Sure, Dean. It was actually a piece that appeared in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. And people can find it either on our website, which is drugpolicy.org, or on the Foreign Policy magazine site. Essentially, I argued that when it comes to Latin America, really, the optimal solution for Latin America is legalization. You know, and I don't make that claim with respect to the United States for all drugs. I don't know if that's the best policy. But you go to Latin America and you look at Colombia and you look at some of these other countries and you realize they are just like Chicago under Al Capone during alcohol prohibition times 50. I mean, the level of violence and murder and corruption and black markets, what have you, is just off the charts. I have no doubt that if the United States had had to deal with the levels of prohibition-inspired violence and corruption that Colombia's had to deal with, we would have probably legalized drugs by today. But what I also pointed out was that talking about legalization, even in Latin America, is essentially a non-starter. I mean, you have the president of Uruguay, who said it pretty boldly, and the former foreign minister, and you even have some of the other leaders in Latin America hinting at it. But what they find is if you even say that word, it basically, people run away. They flee. They think it's too radical. And there's no way to go from the current drug policy to that radical alternative. So what I suggested was a few alternatives. You know, one of those was that Latin America could learn a lot from what the Europeans and increasingly North Americans are doing with harm reduction. There's understanding that drugs are here to stay and figuring out ways to reduce the harms both of drug use and of our drug control policies. The second thing I argued was that coca, which is the plant from which cocaine is made, I mean, coca is also used to make a lot more other things like teas and tonics and what have you, lozenges, that are probably no more addictive than coffee or Coca-Cola. In fact, you know, until 1900, Coca-Cola did have cocaine in it. And so far as we know, there wasn't any massive Coca-Cola addiction problem at that time. So what I suggested was that Latin American countries get together behind opening up a global market in low-potency coca-based products, that that could potentially be a source of revenue worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Bolivia and Peru and maybe other countries. Such a market did exist a little over 100 years ago, and it would be a good thing for it to happen today. And the last thing I suggested was that essentially Latin American governments need to get their act together. They need to begin to speak in unison. You know, the United States government, I mean, I'm very much a loyal citizen and a, you know, patriotic American, but that doesn't mean that every single thing my federal government does is the right thing. What they're doing with the drug war, both domestically and internationally, is causing a lot more harm than good. And they need to hear opposition. They need to hear opposition from folks like you and me within the United States, and they need to hear and see coordinated opposition happening outside the United States.
Indeed, they do. Ethan, there was a story, I didn't copy it, but it was in today's Chronicle, something to the effect that one of the rebel leaders of the AUC, I believe it was saying that they're willing to step down from their war. He says, yes, they've been involved in massacres and drug smuggling and so forth, but they're going to quit by 2005. And, you know, it's like we send the money down there to the military, who in turn funds the paramilitary, who in turn massacres the people.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I mean, I think I'm always a little torn on that whole situation in Colombia, though, I have to say. Because on the one hand, I know that the U.S. drug war, the U.S. drug prohibition policies have wreaked havoc in Colombia and throughout Latin America. We have exported the problems of Chicago and Al Capone to an entire continent. So there's no question that at the very least we should just stop doing that and would have a tremendously positive impact. I mean, you know, black market, you know, drug sales is a major source of revenue both for the left wing and the right wing, you know, violent organizations in that country. When it comes to Colombia's bigger problems, you know, their problems with left and right wing insurgencies and lack of democracy and poverty, I don't really know what the answer is there. I mean, it seems to me that for the U.S., if you can't, you know, do something right, then maybe you're just best off not being involved at all. Maybe the best answer is just for us to pull the hell out of there. On the other hand, there's also people in Colombia who are really fighting the good fight to try to make a healthier, more decent country. And some of them are calling for our aid and help. So although I lean in favor of the U.S., of saying the U.S. government should just stop sending this money down because it's landing up in the wrong hands and doing all this harm, I can't totally shut off those voices which are saying that Colombia is trying to do something bigger and better as well.
All right. Thank you, sir. Over the weekend, I saw a piece about GW Pharmaceuticals, an interview with their founder, Joffrey Guy. And it stated that marijuana, the studies they've done have shown that marijuana is effective in slowing tumor growth, that it sometimes helps to rebuild nerve damage. You know, it helps with brain swelling from a head injury. It can help with stroke, so on and so forth. And I learned that it's now to be sold by America's own Bayer Pharmaceuticals. And I wonder, how will that impact the long-term, you know, what are the implications for marijuana here in the U.S. in that regard?
Well, it could have a major impact, Dan. I mean, you know, this, you know, first of all, about a month or two ago, an article appeared in the British journal The Lancet, which is their outstanding medical journal, sort of like our New England Journal of Medicine or Journal of American Medical Association. And one of the authors was subsequently quoted saying that marijuana could well emerge as the aspirin of the 21st century. In other words, the drug that has far more and diverse beneficial effects than we ever anticipated. Now, I have to say that when some of my colleagues and friends would make this claim 4 or 5 years ago, I would tell them to shut up. I'd say, don't say that. You're going to delegitimize yourself even if what you're saying is true. But now you see one of the leading medical journals in the world and somebody not at all involved in the whole marijuana reform movement saying the same thing. So I think what we're beginning to see is that the positive medical value of marijuana and of its constituent elements is becoming more and more a subject of study, more and more a subject of interest. There's an annual cannabis science conference, marijuana science conference, that goes on each year. And in the past, this was always dominated by people trying to find what's bad about marijuana, what's wrong. you know, spending the billions of dollars that the federal government have thrown at this. But now, for the first time, you see scientists beginning to talk about, what is it about marijuana that maybe helps reduce cancers or reduce muscle spasms or enhance appetite or delay Alzheimer's or whatever it might be? I mean, marijuana is turning out to be a spectacularly interesting drug. Now, the problem, of course, is that so long as the principal form of consuming it is smoking, well, you know, we live in a country right now where, for a lot of good reasons and a few bad ones, we have this huge, huge anti-smoking campaign going on. I mean, people are being told, and young people are being told somewhat properly, that inhaling smoke into your lungs is not a smart thing to do, and that it can cause cancer if you do enough of it. Now, we may be at times taking this overboard and not distinguishing between the occasional smoke and people who smoke 20 cigarettes a day, but what this GW Pharmaceuticals, what the new researchers are doing in England and elsewhere, is looking and designing ways of taking marijuana for particular marijuana conditions in ways that do not involve smoking. Taking it through vaporizers and edible forms, trying to break out the different ingredients of marijuana to see which ones are most valuable. So I think that that research is really going to transform the whole debate, actually, about marijuana during the course of the next decade or two.
Thank you. I just want a quick comment that while in California, I did try out that German-made Volcano vaporizer. Quite spectacular, mild, and totally non-irritating.
Yeah, and I believe there's even now some research indicating that, in fact, when marijuana is consumed through these vaporizer devices, that essentially people get the full impact of the marijuana, whether it's medicinal or mind-altering recreational, but with virtually no carcinogens entering the lung. And that's very, very promising. You know, one of the things, you know, people, you know, the government likes to say about how marijuana today is much more potent than it used to be. And that's mostly a crock. Most of us who got, you know, high 20, 25 years ago on marijuana remember smoking some very powerful stuff back then, just as is true today. But the truth of it is that when you smoke more potent marijuana, you smoke less. You know, you smoke one or two hit marijuana, that's a lot less damaging to the human lungs and the human body than is smoking the kind of crappy Mexican pot that used to be more common with very low THC that wreaked havoc on the lungs.
I remember, you know, tribal homes I lived in where more than an ounce a day was not unusual.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, again, low-grade Mexican stuff down here in Texas. All right, we're going to take just a short break, and we want to take a couple of calls. Please have a short question ready for us. Our number, 713-526-5738.
If you want to get the lowdown, the truth about the drug war, I suggest you visit the website of the Drug Policy Alliance. That's drugpolicy.org. There you can find information from Congress, across this nation, and from around the world that will set the record straight.
It's a reefer day, I want some policeman. It's a reefer day, I want a blast. It's a reefer day, I want some policeman. Or would you prepare me to shove it up?
Whoa, time to take listener questions.
Okay, let's go to Frank on line one. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Dean. I want to thank the Drug Policy Alliance for everything they're doing in all their efforts to end the drug war. And I would like to ask them if they could try to get more news out to the American people about the true, I mean, how dirty and how racist the marijuana laws are, if they could help push and let the, you know, slap the American people and wake them up to how racist these laws began. That's what I've been trying to get out. And I know DPA, Drug Policy Alliance, is doing an awesome job getting information out about marijuana, and hopefully, you know, they can maybe enlighten the people the true origin of the laws.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate what you're saying. I mean, I think for many of your callers may know, but just to say that, you know, racism played a major role in the onset of drug prohibition. The first anti-opium laws in this country were in Nevada and California, and were very clearly directed at Chinese minorities and Chinese immigrants who oftentimes would work long, hard days and then kick back with an opium pipe. But, you know, there was felt a need to target them. The first anti-cocaine laws were directed at blacks in the South. The first anti-marijuana laws at Mexicans and Mexican-Americans in the Southwest in the teens and the 20s. So we see this kind of racist strain of the drug war really right from the beginning up to the current day, when we have this grossly disproportionate impact of the drug war on Latino and black communities in this country. But the other thing I can say is, you know, Drug Policy Alliance may be the leading organization in the country, if not the world, promoting alternatives to the war on drugs. But our ability to be effective really depends upon how many people are with us. You know, we have about 10,000 members who contribute a little bit of money. We have about 50,000 who are on our email list. So anybody listening to this call, if you do believe and do care about ending the war on drugs, just please do go to the website. It's drugpolicy.org and sign up. Send in a couple bucks if you can, and at the very least sign up on our activist list. Because we're beginning to see that we now have the capacity to generate hundreds and even thousands of letters and faxes to legislators at the state and federal level. We increasingly have the ability to reach the most influential politicians in America through people who are supporters of our organization. The more we have that, the more we're going to exert the influence that other powerful advocacy organizations also are able to assert.
Thank you. Let's go to Catherine on line two. Hello, Catherine.
Yes.
Quick question.
I had heard a report just before I left the house and started listening to the show that the government was in the process of developing testing for DNA so that they could connect strands of marijuana to growers and users. And I was wondering what you all thought the potential for that could be combined with the new Patriot laws, and also what the potential for legalization that that could bring.
Thank you, Catherine. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's been in the papers the last few weeks. They already do this. The DEA and the government already does this sort of signature analysis on opium, so that they're able to tell by looking, by diagnosing heroin, where it most likely came from and where it was refined. They're trying to do something even more sophisticated with respect to marijuana. In the end, you know, it's about trying to, I don't know how useful it's going to be as a law enforcement tactic. I mean, to some extent, they're trying to identify which strains of marijuana came from where. It could potentially be used for law enforcement purposes. I don't know how far this is going to go. I don't know how reliable it is. The upside, by the way, is this may actually have some positive value in terms of identifying the medical properties of marijuana. We'll be able to better understand why certain strains work better on different types of conditions. In terms of broader legalization, I don't know if this issue plays out at all. But what's interesting is that the percentage of Americans who support treating marijuana basically like alcohol, a policy of taxing it, controlling it, regulating it, and maybe just trying to keep it away from kids, that's growing from like in the low 20% about a decade ago up to, I think we just found 41% of all Americans now say treat marijuana like alcohol, and it's approaching 50% in some states. So I see that the public increasingly is saying the war on marijuana has failed. An overwhelming number say that at the very least, we should decriminalize it. We should stop locking people up for simple possession. But 2 out of 5 Americans now say treat it like alcohol. I think we're headed in the right direction.
You bet we are, Ethan. Real quick, let's go to Bill on line 3. Hello, Bill.
Hey.
Real quick, please.
With the privatizations of prisons, do you think they're ever going to do anything with the drug laws? They'd rather have potheads in jail than murderers and rapers because they're throwing them out on the street after 10, 15 years anyway.
You know, the scary thing is I sometimes worry that now with the anti-terrorism stuff, they're going to start filling up the prisons instead with legal and illegal immigrants and all sorts of terrorism suspects. I'd also say that although I'm very concerned with the ways in which the private prison industry is pushing for tougher and tougher drug laws and other laws, I'm just as concerned about the prison guards union. I mean, in California, the prison guards union is one of the most powerful political forces in the state, and they've been among our principal opponents. So I just thank God that the private prison folks and the prison guard unions can't stand one another. Otherwise, we'd really be in serious trouble.
Thanks, Ethan. I want to make 2 quick points, and then we'll try to get one more call, perhaps. I had been doing a Coward of the Week. This week I'm starting with Hero of the Week, and I really don't have time for it, but I want to say for standing up so bravely in the halls of Congress and speaking her mind, I want to nominate this week for Hero of the Week, Houston's own Sheila Jackson Lee. And I want to tell you that next week our guest will be the creator of drug policy, of the druglibrary.org, Cliff Schaefer. Looks like we got about a minute. Real quick. We have 1 minute, Steve. Rick, you have a quick question.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I do, Rick. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question's real quick, 2-parter. Bumped into some drug counselor I met years, you know, became a drug counselor, and he basically told me marijuana, because it mimics estrogen, makes you grow breasts, and they saw men in prison with breasts, and he also said that The effects for treating glaucoma are short-lived and not medically significant. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, so far as I know, there's absolutely no evidence associated with growing breasts. That was a myth propagated by the Reagan drug czar many years ago and is ridiculous. In terms of glaucoma, my understanding is that marijuana does help with glaucoma, but that there are other medications that work just as well or as well. Marijuana is more useful for medical purposes with things like AIDS wasting syndrome, appetite loss, spasms, etc., where oftentimes the alternative medications are not as effective or much
Ethan,
more costly or have negative side effects.
Ethan, thank you so much, sir. We have to go. I thank all the callers. I'm sorry we didn't get to y'all. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth.